Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Jacques Pepin. Dr. Pepin is an infectious disease professor at the University of Sherbrooke in Quebec, Canada. He's also the author of a recent book entitled The Origin of AIDS. This book, to me, is the result of some meticulous research into historical data, very clear epidemiologic reasoning and techniques, and a very extensive knowledge of the science of virology. Probably few in the world could have mustered all this together to write such a book. In a review in the journal Science, the former executive director of the Joint United Nations Program on HIV and AIDS has commented that unless someone completely new evidence emerges, it would be difficult to come up with a better explanation than Dr. Pepin's of the origin of AIDS. Dr. Pepin, it's a real pleasure to have you join us by telephone from your home in Quebec.
And it's a pleasure to be here, too.
Our listeners are pretty much private individuals, not necessarily terribly medically oriented, but often with lots of interest in medicine and science, and we're trying to give them good information. So I want to start today by just some basic information. Let's talk about viruses and perhaps distinguish them from bacteria before we get into that the one particular virus we want to concentrate on today.
Yeah, so viruses in general, they are the smallest of the various categories of microbial agents that cause infectious diseases. So the other types of microbial agents, for example, bacteria, fungi, and parasites, they are large enough to be seen using an ordinary microscope. And viruses, of course, are much, much smaller. And they're also organisms which require another cell to live. So they cannot live on their own. They have to infect some other cells, either human cells or animal cells, and then they use the various components of these cells to replicate. So that's what distinguishes viruses from other pathogens.
And viruses not only infect humans and animals and plants, but they also infect other bacteria as well. Is that correct?
That's true. That's correct, yeah.
I recently, to just try to help listeners envision this organism, again, I heard an analogy not very long ago, I don't remember where, but it was asked the listeners to pay attention, to imagine a peanut. So a peanut is a virus with this genetic material is in the middle, that's what we eat, and the core is the covering in the in a sense, viruses attach to various cells, they get rid of their coating, enter the cell, and then come back out and recoat themselves as they spread around attack and attach to various other cells. Is that is that helpful, or am I messing things up there?
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary. Of course, there are different types of viruses, but the one which we are interested in today, HIV, actually it's a very small genome, which is about 7,500 or 8,000 pairs of base. Eventually, it kind of integrates within the human DNA within the cell, and then this is used for the purpose of the replication of the virus. And from the first cell, it then infects the second cell, and so on. So your summary was pretty good.
Let me take 1 second just to remind listeners, if you have questions or comments about the origin of AIDS, HIV, even treatment, we have an expert on the line today, and you can easily call, and you're welcome to ask questions or make comments. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. One thing that's really always fascinating to me is how organisms have evolved. And these viruses attach to cells through receptors. And what's really seems to be very interesting is that the way they've learned to do that is they've evolved to attach to receptors that are not specific for themselves. They're receptors for other hormones or proteins within the body. Is that what happens with the human immunodeficiency virus as well?
Well, the main receptor of HIV is the CD4 antigen of lymphocytes, which are called CD4 lymphocytes. So this is how it preferentially infects these cells and eventually leads to the destruction of a large fraction of the population of CD4 lymphocytes. And, of course, that's the basis for all the what we call opportunistic infections, so the infections that develop as a consequence of HIV infection. So it is really related to the property of HIV of binding to this specific receptor. Now, whether, you know, other viruses or some other viruses might be able actually to bind to the same type of cell, but they don't cause its destruction is the destruction as well as HIV. So I'm not sure with, you know, mm-hmm. to what extent right. this is relevant.
Right, I got you. All right, but these particular kind of lymphocytes, which are often help us prevent us from getting or fight off viral infections, and as you said, other opportunistic infections, are then destroyed by the presence of the HIV infection, and that's what eventually does us in, is these opportunistic infections?
Absolutely. So normally we all have about 1,000 CD4 lymphocytes per microliter of blood, and when you get infected with HIV, it takes several years, but progressively this CD4 count, the number of CD4 lymphocytes in your blood, it goes down from 1,000 to 500, 300, and eventually when it gets as low as 200 per cubic microliter, then you start developing opportunistic infections. And that's when, in the old days, people used to develop infections that were diagnostic of AIDS. And eventually, as the disease progresses without treatment, the CD4 count can be very low as two or three cells per microliter instead of 1,000. So that's the natural history of HIV infection without treatment.
I know from reading your book that it generally takes on an average of about 10 years to get to this state that we call this acquired immune deficiency syndrome or AIDS.
Yeah, that's true. So that's the incubation period between the time you get infected with HIV and the time that you develop symptoms of AIDS, about 10 years on average. Some people it's much longer, some people it's much shorter, but that's the average incubation period.
And once infected, how long does it take for someone to be contagious then to others, that they could transmit it? Is there a window where there is very little transmission and then a buildup in the number of viruses that increases the risk?
Well, actually, there are two periods during this long period of time. There are two periods when there is probably much higher transmission. First, in the 3 or 4 months that follow infection. So if somebody gets infected, this person develops what we call primary HIV infection. And over 2 or 3 or 4 months, this person has extremely high level of viremia. So the quantity of HIV viruses present in the blood are extremely high. And during that period of time, this patient is highly infectious. And there is some information from studies in Canada, in the U.S., in Western Europe, that suggests that actually if you look at HIV transmission within the gay community, probably something like 50% of all new infections are actually transmitted by a person who has been infected for just a few months. So during this period of time, which doesn't last too long, there is a high risk of transmission. After that, your immune system is able to control HIV to some extent, so the quantity of viruses in your blood goes down substantially. And then if you're not treated, well, about 10 years later, when you start developing symptoms, the quantity of virus in the blood goes up again to very high levels. And then there's also a higher risk of transmission. But at this other end of the spectrum, because people are becoming sick, they also tend to become less active sexually. So actually, a very substantial fraction of all cases of transmission of HIV occur during the first few months that follow an infection.
As I would think about that bit of information about what we know about the virology of the human immunodeficiency virus, I would wonder what we know about why the number of copies of the virus decreases in the bloodstream and becomes less contagious to others. Do we know what it is about the immune system or the virus or the natural history of the virus that causes that decrease in the number of copies of the virus?
I think it's the immune system. Basically, you develop antibodies which are never good enough to clear the infection, to completely kill the virus. But for a period of time, these antibodies are able at least to decrease the quantity of viruses in your blood, and then the viremia decreases. And eventually, over a long period of time, the immune system, both the part that produces antibodies and the part that fights infection through what we call cell-mediated immunity, the immune system gets kind of tired and less competent, and eventually it's no longer able to control the virus, and the high degree of viremia goes up again.
We all are aware that it is sexually transmitted. Most of us are aware there may be some at risk from blood exposures. How does the risk of transmission of the virus differ with various potential modes of transmission?
Well, in general, and that's the route of transmission which has been better studied, for heterosexual transmission, it is estimated that if a seropositive person has heterosexual sex with a seronegative partner, the risk of transmission is about 1 in 1,000. So for each intercourse, you have 1 in 1,000 chance of transmission. For homosexual sex, it is certainly higher, perhaps something like 1 chance out of 500 or 1 chance out of 300. And then if you look at the other routes of transmission, for example, when intravenous drug addicts share a syringe or a needle in which there is some blood which is left from the first user and that's then injected to a second intravenous drug user, the probability of transmission then is about 1 in 100. So it's more effective than when it is sexual transmission. And then at the extreme end of the spectrum, if you get a blood transfusion from a person who is HIV infected, so that's what used to happen in the early 80s before HIV serological tests were developed, well, the probability of transmission is close to 100%.
Okay. How about just a little bit more about AIDS in general before we move on to what you were able to fathom about how this epidemic came about? Let's put it in some perspective now. The number of people that have died, the number that are currently infected, and what is expected with treatment now. Just some perspective of the seriousness of this particular infection.
Well, overall, the current estimation is that about 67 million people have been infected with HIV worldwide, and about half of them have already died from that disease. So the death toll so far worldwide has been about 33 million. And currently, UNAIDS estimates that about 34 million people are living with HIV. Now, with the availability of highly active treatments for the last in developed countries for the last 15 years in the U.S., in Canada, in Western Europe, the mortality from AIDS has decreased more than tenfold. So it's become more it's become a chronic disease, a bit like diabetes or high cholesterol. So you need to be treated permanently, but the mortality has been much reduced. In most of the developing world, until about 5 years ago, there was no treatment available. So basically, having AIDS was like a death sentence. For the last few last 4 or 5 years, through a number of initiatives, and one of these, a very important one, was the it's called PEPFAR, so the Presidential Initiative for AIDS Treatment around the world, that's been funded by the U.S. government for 5 or 6 years, and other donors have joined the effort as well. A substantial fraction of patients in the developing world, including sub-Saharan Africa, are being treated, but it's only a minority of patients. In some countries like South Africa, it's probably more than half of the patients, but if you look at the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, I would say that about 25-30% of patients who would need treatment are receiving treatment currently. So this is also having an impact on mortality, but because it's not as widely available as in the U.S. and Canada, it's the improvement has been moderate rather than extremely good as in the U.S. But certainly the situation has improved. But there's a lot of concern with the current economic crisis that the funding for such programs is decreasing. People in developing countries who have been treated for 2 or 3 years are developing resistance to the drugs that they've been given, and then they require drugs, second line or third line drugs, which are more expensive. So it's a bit unclear at the present time whether it will be possible to sustain this availability of drugs for the developing world. I'm not sure what the answer will be.
Why is it that we can virtually cure a person of an infection with strep or perhaps pneumonia, but we can't do it with many viruses, and in particular the human immunodeficiency virus infection?
Well, in the case of HIV, and there are probably several reasons for that, but the probably one of the main ones is that the virus it's a virus which is its genome is made of RNA, and it has an enzyme which is called reverse transcriptase, which will convert this RNA into DNA, and then the DNA of HIV will then integrate within the DNA of the host cell, of the human cell. And there it's impossible, of course, for the immune response to tackle it. So that's probably one of the reasons. Another reason is the tremendous capacity of HIV to go through a rapid evolution. So this enzyme, which I've just described, makes a lot of errors in replication. So basically, over a period of 1 or 2 years, the virus changes very rapidly compared to other viruses or to other pathogens, and so that the immune system is kind of facing a different challenge, like, you know, every year. So that's also part of the explanation for that.
Okay. Let me remind listeners once again, my guest today on line one is Dr. Jacques Pepin. He's a professor of infectious disease at the University of Sherbrooke in Quebec, Canada. We're talking about his book, The Origin of AIDS. Actually, what we're doing is trying to get some basic information about HIV and AIDS before we perhaps talk a little bit about his book and what he has found and some studies about the history of this organism. Is that the reasons you just described, part of the reasons why a vaccine has also not been produced at this particular time? And then what is your opinion about the likelihood that perhaps a vaccine will sometime be developed?
Well, I would say that over my lifetime, it's unlikely that a HIV vaccine will become available. If you look at the history of HIV vaccines, you know, 20 years ago, scientists were all saying, okay, in 5 years, we're going to have a vaccine. And 20 years later, we still don't have anything. And, you know, if you look at the history of effective vaccines, and you're a pediatrician, so, I mean, you've worked a lot with these diseases. But in general, if you look at vaccines which have been very highly effective, these are infections which by themselves generated a very substantial immune response. In other words, if you got measles once, well, you were protected against measles for the rest of your life. And if you got rubella once, you would be protected against rubella for the rest of your life, and so on. So the natural infection would cause a lifelong immunity. So then it's possible for people who develop a vaccine to try to replicate to some extent the effects of the natural infection, and then you get a lifelong immunity and you get a very effective vaccine. Now for HIV, because even when you get the natural infection with the virus itself, it's not sufficient for you to develop an immune response that will eliminate the virus. So it's going to be mm-hmm. very difficult mm-hmm. with a vaccine to generate an immune response which would be better than what you get with the virus itself. So personally, I think it's a long shot, maybe in 25 years or something like that. But in the meantime, that might be less relevant for the United States, but for the developing world, there are other tools which have been documented to be extremely effective, and over the last few years, there's been a lot of interest about the efficacy of male circumcision in preventing HIV. Three very good studies in East and Southern Africa have documented that with male circumcision, you can reduce by 50 to 60% the likelihood of getting infected with HIV. And so I think it's important not to wait for the holy grail, you know, the vaccine that would be the solution. We have, for the developing world, we have a tool which is 50 to 60% effective. I think it's important to make it available. And there are already some efforts in that direction. And PEPFAR, the American program which I mentioned earlier, they've already supporting making circumcision more available in some countries of Africa. So I think for the short term and the middle term, that's much more likely to be useful than waiting for a vaccine.
In a lot of the work that you have done has focused on looking at historical documents, historical records, and it's my understanding that has allowed you to become aware that genetic factors are perhaps important in susceptibility to diseases. And I'd like you to comment perhaps on that. But in along the same line, we know that there are rare individuals who apparently cannot be infected with HIV because, as I understand it, they lack, in a sense, that receptor for that virus to attached to. Is that true, and does that lead to any suggestions about prevention?
Well, for several years, and I think other people have the same opinion. I believe that actually, if you look at populations, if you compare populations, they probably differ in their biological susceptibility to HIV infection. So, for example, what I told you a few minutes ago, that you know the chance of transmission for each intercourse was about 1 in 1,000. These are studies made in North America and in Western Europe. I think it's very likely that in some societies, especially in Southern Africa, the probability of transmission per sexual act is not 1 in 1,000, but it might be, you know, 1 in 200, or perhaps even 1 in 100. And that would explain the extremely rapid spread of HIV in these countries. Now, what would be the mechanism? I think that's a fascinating question. What you've mentioned is true, that some of the explanation, but that's only a small part of the explanation. Some of the explanation is related to what we call a co-receptor of HIV. So I mentioned earlier that when HIV infects a lymphocyte, its main receptor is what's called CD4. Now, there are other co-receptors which help HIV attach to the cell, and at least one variation in one of these co-receptors provides some protection against HIV. So you're not completely resistant to HIV, but the likelihood of an infection is much smaller. Mm-hmm. That explains some of the variation in susceptibility to HIV across the world, but certainly not all of it. And certainly if the main factors for this variation in susceptibility could be identified, that might help in developing a vaccine. But for now, it's only speculation.
It appeared from my reading in your book also that it may be that there's an increased risk of transmission if there are other diseases present at the same time in the individual, or are perhaps transmitted at the same time, other sexually transmitted diseases?
Absolutely. So that's been known for a long time, actually, that the other sexually transmitted infections, they increase the likelihood of HIV transmission. So basically, the ulcers that cause a genital ulcer, for example, herpes or syphilis, they will increase about fivefold the likelihood of transmission. And the other STDs, which cause a discharge, so for example, chlamydia or gonorrhea, they will increase this probability of transmission about twofold. So that explains to some extent the higher transmission in some parts of the world, but certainly not completely. Now, it's possible that other diseases indirectly increase also the likelihood of transmission. So there's some research which shows that, for example, with malaria or with tuberculosis, the quantity of HIV that a person has in his or her blood will increase during this infection, so that person may be more infectious to others. So it's possible that other infectious diseases as well increase the transmission of HIV.
All right. We need to take a short break. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll return to listen to Dr. Jacques Pepin answer our questions. I should mention that over the break, it'll be Neil Conan making a short comment about why we need your membership to help us to present such programs as you're hearing today. This is Dr. Thad Woodard.
Hello, this is Neil Conan, host of Talk of the Nation from NPR News. For 20 years now, KSKA has helped you be part of the conversations about how the brain works on Line One, your health connection, conditions in the Arctic on Talk of Alaska, quizzing candidates on Hometown Alaska and Science Fridays on Talk of the Nation. KSKA is listener-supported radio, and right now we're asking you to call in with your financial support. Please call 550-8484 or call toll-free 1-800-478-5256. Whatever amount is right for you is the right amount for KSKA, where every pledge counts and every member matters. KSKA, the Alaska Public Radio Network, NPR, and the BBC all work together to provide the quality programming you've come to expect and deserve. Thanks for listening, and thank you for supporting KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is the origin of AIDS. This is the title of a book by Dr. Jacques Pepin, who is our guest. He's professor of infectious disease at the University of Sherbrooke in Quebec, Canada. You can give us a call during the next 30 minutes or so at 550-8433 if you have questions or comments. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And please remember the usual warning. If you're listening between 7 and 8 local time in Anchorage, you're listening to a recorded broadcast. Dr. Pepin, we do have a phone call I want to take. Peter, you're on line 1. What can we do for you?
Yes, thank you for taking the call. And I am a longtime member of the station. I have two quick questions. Does HIV penetrate the intact skin? And how long does it last in the environment off the body?
Okay. Dr. Pepin, did you hear those questions?
Well, the intact skin, I think the answer to that is no. In fact, if we look at, for example, the healthcare workers who've been exposed to the blood of some HIV-infected persons, If the healthcare workers sustain an injury, so if the needle penetrated the skin or into the muscle, then there's a risk of transmission of HIV. But if the skin itself was not damaged by the injection or something else, then there is no risk of transmission of HIV. And of course the most cases of HIV transmission occur through sexual intercourse. So now it's not the skin, but it's the genital epithelium which is the target of the virus. But by the skin itself, I would say the risk of transmission through the skin, if it's not damaged, it must be extremely low and close to zero. Now, for how long does it persist? It depends. Actually, the transmission from man to a woman is more effective than from a woman to a man, and that's probably related to anatomical factors. So after sexual intercourse, if the man is HIV infected, so there'll be some HIV in the sperm, and that will persist within the fornix of the vagina for a couple of days, and then it's easier for the virus to actually infect some target cells and eventually to start an infection. So between the moment of contact and the moment of infection, I think it's possible for the virus in women to persist for a few days. In men, it's probably shorter, but I'm not sure what would be the exact duration.
How about in inanimate objects, say on a tabletop or on a hand?
Oh, I'm not sure, but the duration of survival of HIV in such circumstances must be very short. I'm not sure exactly, but you know, there's no instance of any kind of transmission from such contamination of various objects. So I think it must be very short. In what we know is in needles and syringes, this has been studied. And, you know, if an intravenous drug user injects heroin or cocaine And then some of this person's blood remain in the syringe, a small quantity, but it remains in the syringe and the needle. It can persist within the needle for a few days, something of that order of magnitude.
Okay.
You know, more than a few hours, but certainly less than 2 weeks, so just a few days.
Okay. Peter, did that help you?
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, appreciate it. Appreciate your call. All right, let's move on to this epidemic that is, as you said, infected 67 million people, and at least half of those who've died. It was first recognized roughly around 30 years ago in California, but you've gone in and been working in Africa for a number of years and have found that the origin may date back to the 20s. Would you mind telling us this story?
Yeah, so part of the story is some work which I've done around the book which I've published, and some of it is the work of other scientists which I've summarized in various chapters of the book. But basically, we know for sure now that the source of HIV-1, the one that caused the pandemic and is prevalent in the U.S., the source of HIV-1 is a chimpanzee of Central Africa, a specific subspecies of chimpanzee, which lives in just a few countries of Central Africa. So, for example, Southern Cameroon, Gabon, Congo-Brazzaville, Central African Republic. So a small part of Central Africa. And we are pretty certain that the very first person who was infected was probably a hunter who got infected while manipulating chimpanzee meat, either in the forest or back home in his village, trying to prepare it for cooking. And that hunter probably got infected while sustaining an injury, so maybe with the knife that was used to cut out the chimpanzee meat. There was the patient got an injury, and the chimpanzee's blood got into contact with the person's blood. So, and we know from very complex molecular tools that the moment that the year that this first case existed was probably around 1921. There is some margin of error on that estimate. So certainly in the first three decades of the 20th century, but the most likely year, if you want to remember just one, would be around 1921. And then for 60 years, before the disease was recognized, as you said, it was recognized in the U.S. in 1981. Well, prior to that, for at least 60 years, the virus had been spreading initially in Central Africa. So in the countries where you can find its chimpanzee source, and then the virus slowly spread through the Congo River. The Congo River is like a natural highway in this part of the world. So even before colonization, and even when in the early years of colonization, and even nowadays, the Congo River is used as a major route for transportation of persons, transportation of goods, and so on. So a lot of traders use the Congo River for their businesses. So eventually, through the migration of persons infected, the virus arrives in what used to be and still is the largest city in that part of the world. It used to be called Léopoldville. It's now known as Kinshasa. It's been there certainly for maybe at least 60 years or more. And then eventually it's in that city that it managed to reach a critical mass. So the number of persons infected became large enough. So then it would successfully disseminate in other parts of the world. So from there, we know it disseminated throughout Africa. And using molecular tools, it's possible to follow various routes of transmission of the virus. So, for example, the one which is called subtype C, it probably went from Kinshasa to the second largest city of the country, which is now known as Lubumbashi, from there to Zambia, which is just next door. From Zambia, eventually it reached South Africa. And from South Africa, it was re-exported to India, among other places. And so it's possible to follow also the route of transmission of subtype B. So subtype B, we think it was exported from the Congo to Haiti around 1967. And from Haiti, just a few years later, probably 3 or 4 years later, it was re-exported to the U.S., arriving there in the early 1970s. And then it spread within the United States, initially mostly within the homosexual community, eventually to the intravenous drug users. And then these people needed about 10 years before they developed symptoms of what would become AIDS. And so eventually the disease was recognized in 1981. But after it had been spreading for at least 60 or 70 years.
You you didn't comment on what I think is the unfortunate reasons for the amplification. You make the point in the book that the virus is probably the simian virus, very similar to the HIV, the simian immune deficiency virus, has been present probably for thousands of years, but certain conditions prevented it from being spread to humans, such as the maybe rifles and ability to shoot and then have as much exposure to blood. But then the amplification issue didn't have its opportunity. Would you mind commenting on this very, very unfortunate situation?
So in the book, I explain how it is very likely that there were two important factors that eventually allowed the successful spread of HIV. So one was the urbanization of this part of Africa. The colonial powers created cities in which there was an excess of men compared to the number of women. That generated prostitution. So eventually, this facilitated the sexual transmission of HIV. But I explain in the book, there are several chapters about that, that probably the main factor, at least initially, was the transmission of HIV through injections. And these injections were actually made during very large-scale public health interventions for the control of a few selected tropical diseases. So what happened was that starting after World War One and into the early 1920s, 1930s, the French and eventually the Belgian colonial authorities decided that they would try to control some tropical diseases. It started with one called sleeping sickness, and eventually syphilis, and one which is called yaws and leprosy and so on. And to do that, they organized the systematic screening of the whole population of these countries. So they would basically visit each and every village about twice a year. They would examine the whole population. And those who were found to be infected with sleeping sickness or with syphilis or with yaws, they would be treated right there in the village. And the treatments that they were using at the time were drugs, mostly based on arsenical compounds. And these drugs, they were not very effective. To get some effect, they had to be given intravenously. And so there was a massive use of intravenous injections, which were given with syringes and needles, of course, that were reused between patients. You know, the single-use syringe and single-use needle appeared maybe 75 years later. So at that time, they were using glass syringes and needles that were constantly reused. And because they at the time, they didn't have any understanding of viruses in general, and certainly not of blood-borne viruses. They didn't understand the risk that was associated with these injections. And so basically, between the first patient who was treated for a given disease and the second patient who was treated maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes later, they were merely rinsing the syringe and the needle with water. So there was a tremendous opportunity for the transmission of viruses from a first person, so maybe the hunter, the very first one who started the pandemic. Eventually, that person may have been treated for sleeping sickness or maybe for syphilis or for yaws. And through the syringe and the needle that was then used on some other patients during the same day, a second patient eventually was infected through the injections. And that second patient then developed the high degree of viremia that we discussed earlier in the show, so that in the early phase of HIV infection. So the second person's blood was highly infectious, and that second person kept being treated for several weeks with the intravenous injections. And then from the second person, eventually a third one was infected, eventually a fourth one, and so on. And eventually a vicious circle developed in some of these hospitals or dispensaries. And from a single patient, eventually the health system generated certainly a few hundreds and maybe even a few thousands of cases of HIV infection. And once so many people had been infected in the bush, in the remote villages where they were living, it was unavoidable that some of them would eventually migrate down the Congo River and eventually reach the large cities of Leopoldville and Brazzaville. And then they were also the same conditions for the transmission of HIV in Leopoldville. And there's a chapter in the book where I explain that actually it's quite likely that in Leopoldville there was a substantial part of the transmission which occurred in the clinic for sexually transmitted diseases, where they made an incredible number of intravenous injections. So again, in Leopoldville, the virus was amplified by the medical injections. And again, that created a large number of infected persons in Leopoldville. And after that, as I mentioned, the virus had reached its critical mass. It became unavoidable that it would disseminate in other parts of the world. And that's what happened. So certainly, medical interventions and public health campaigns against tropical diseases, I believe, played a very important role in the emergence of HIV. And that's one of the lessons that we should not forget about HIV. It's that medical interventions and, in general, scientific work, when scientists and physicians manipulate nature in a way that they do not fully understand, they can be unpredictable and potentially disastrous consequences. And the AIDS pandemic is really a reminder that we, by we I mean physicians and scientists, in the future, hopefully, we should be more prudent and more humble in our work.
Yeah. It's a truly amazing story, and it seems to be extremely well documented. It's just amazing the meticulousness that I noted in particularly the look at old records and then finding old specimens where antibody studies could be done to document that the infection was present in people years before it became an obvious source of problems in the 1980s.
Absolutely, and the one of the reasons this was possible was that the public health interventions which I've described, which initially were made in French colonies, they were French colonial medicine was organized within the French military. So the head of the health system was a general, And, you know, if the general decided that we would do such and such type of interventions, the orders were followed down the chain of command. And the same thing was true for the reports. So the annual reports of each hospital, each health center, and each disease control team, it was standardized, and, you know, orders were given, and everybody would follow the orders. And eventually the reports were collected, tabulated, and they would move up the chain of command, and it would be centralized somewhere, so that when I actually visited the French Tropical Medicine Institute in Marseille, the quality of the documentation of all these health interventions was just incredible. I mean, they were hundreds of, for some years in some colonies, for example, Cameroon. For 1 year, the annual health report of the colony was something like 800 pages long, with hundreds of tables and graphs describing each and every health intervention, each and every drug, how many injections were made. And so there was an incredible amount of details. So it was possible in retrospect to use that to understand certainly the potential for the transmission of HIV through these modes of transmission. And the other reason why it happened, well, there are several reasons why it happened in the French colonies. Certainly the first one was that the chimpanzee source, if you look at the distribution of the chimpanzee in Central Africa, it corresponded essentially to French colonies. And then the other reason is that the French had very ambitious programs for controlling tropical diseases. So in contrast, for example, to the British colonies, in the British colonies, the doctors were happy to treat the patients who showed up at the hospital. And the others living in the village, it was not their problem. They didn't care too much. Whereas in the French colonies, they had very ambitious goals to control selected tropical diseases. And to do that, they had a census of the whole population. They made sure that everybody was visited twice a year. You know, they had very precise protocols about treatments that had to be given if you were found to have this and or that other diseases. And the result of this dedication was that, indeed, in these countries, the opportunities for the transmission of viruses through injections was much higher than, for example, in British or Portuguese colonies. So it was a kind of a sad consequence of ambitious public health programs.
Before we leave the program, I want to make sure that I mention that a link to Amazon.com that and Dr. Pepin's book, The Origin of AIDS, is available at alaskapublic.org. There is also a video where Dr. Pepin does kind of recapitulate this story in a video format and some other important links. But the book in particular, to people who are fascinated and interested in this story, can be obtained directly by going to alaskapublic.org or any of the regular booksellers. And it's meticulously detailed. There are other episodes and chapters that are fascinating, and in particular, the evidence for how this infection jumped from Haiti back to the United States is well worth reading. We won't get into that to give some people some information about some stimulation to read your book. But I found that also extremely interesting, and a great amount of detective work, I think, was really well done there.
Thank you. Yes, that part of the story is quite amazing, actually. And without getting into the details, the virus was exported from the Congo to Haiti, probably through Haitian technical assistants who went to work in the Congo after the Congo's independence in 1960. And then in Haiti, it was amplified through a plasma business, for-profit plasma center in Port-au-Prince. And eventually, in the early 1970s, Haiti became a popular destination for American homosexual men, and they went to Haiti to, for sexual tourism. And so then there was some homosexual transmission, and from these people, eventually, the virus was re-exported out of Haiti to the United States, and then the rest of the story is well known. But it's true, this part of the story is also quite incredible. So basically what it shows is that the AIDS pandemic was the consequence of a combination of events, and what would have happened without this or that event is hard to say, but it's now possible to some extent through my book, but also I must say through the work of many molecular biologists and epidemiologists, and HIV is a pathogen which has been so well studied. So it was possible for me to examine various parts of the scientific literature and then to put all these small bits and pieces together and assemble a puzzle at the end of the book. And I think most of your listeners will find this quite interesting.
I certainly would agree. I would strongly recommend it to people who are interested. It's very easy read. There is a lot of detail, but I think Dr. Pepin has done a great job of helping us understand the medical and virology aspects of this and how he went about it. Well, we're in our last several minutes. Any final comments you have before we have to sign off? I appreciate the time you've taken.
Are you still there?
Yeah. Yeah, if there's any particular things you want to leave us with, I like to ask people what's the important lessons here?
Yeah, well, the other important lesson, apart from the one I've mentioned about, being prudent when humans manipulate nature, I think the other important lesson of that story is that we live on a planet which really has become a global village. You know, it started with a single hunter in the forest of Central Africa, and eventually it became a pandemic which has changed the lives of people in 200 countries. And I think that's another important lesson, is that we in developed countries like the United States and Canada, we can no longer be only preoccupied with the diseases that are prevalent within our territory. We have to also take care of the diseases which happen in developing countries. Otherwise, one day we will get the problem within our land. So it's a kind of a message that we need to deal with the health problems of the whole world.
Thanks very much, Dr. Pepin. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Okay, thanks a lot. It was a pleasure also. Bye.
Bye-bye. Next week, we're going to be talking with neurophysiologist Dr. Robert Stern about chronic traumatic brain injury, so why don't you join us Monday, April 30th from 2 to 3 p.m. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack helped us today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.